Jimmy and I started this podcast. We started like 20 minutes ago. Like, dude, what are we?
We're like, well, we'll talk about John Gray's first good start. And talk about his pitch count and talk about how he maybe should have gone out for that seventh there in that inning. And they're like, what else do we talk about? And we go,
I don't know, man.
It's one of those kind of weeks.
I don't know. Team is, you know,
no,
not good. The Mets broadcast crew called them bad this morning.
That's a fair assessment, I think.
And like I tweeted, that's like about the nicest way you can describe the way the Rockies are right now. They are,
yeah,
just
even taking two or three from the Nats, you're like, oh well, you know, that could be interesting going forward. And then like, well, that's just the Nats being terrible.
Yep. And that's for the 2010 Rockies right now, down the stretch. So welcome in. It's episode number 56 of the Purple Dinosaur
and
Podcast.
I'm Anthony Masterson.
I'm Tyler Mon. And this week on the show, we are named after...
Well, I mean, there's one guy who wore it for a long time. Franklin Morales took number 56 from 07 to 2014 with a little bit of stops in between there. So I imagine he's going to be the one. But also Logan Kensing, Guillermo Moscoso, Josh Renicki, Ray King... Sean Chacon in 2001, Brian McCray in 1999, and Brian Ricard in 1995.
Man.
He
Brian
wore
Ricard's
every number.
One of those guys who I feel like we've... yeah. Man, there's actually a lot of good names on there. Ray King.
I do remember
man,
Ray King.
Remember Ray
Old
King?
Fat Ray King.
Ray King was like a guy who should have either been a blues musician or owned... Like,
I think he
might have
done both, honestly.
He just like... He just, like, had that look to him, Ray King. Like, the guy you walk in, he's just, like, you know, throwing delicious okra at you. Ray King was
He had 67 appearances
well,
for the
Ray
Rockies
King.
In 2006. A 4.43 ERA. He had 23 strikeouts and 20 walks in 44 and two-thirds innings.
By the way, Baseball References page lists Ray King at 6'1", 225, which is
but they
the
also list his nickname
in history.
As, they also list his nickname as Burger, which is awesome. Ray Burger King.
That is so fitting. 225.
Ray King was at
Come
least
on.
250.
Yeah, in your bra. Yeah. man, there's a whole lot of good options, though. Sean Chacon only wore... 56 in number in 2001, the number 56, and then he switched to 34. So it's not really like you can bring. Although that was when you know, like he had come up and it was the Greeley kid, and everything was so exciting. But you can't really give it to Sean Chacon having only worn for 1 year. Logan Kensing, I am partial to because he was with us in Altoona in 2012. Logan Kensing had a very weird career. Was pretty decent for a while for the Marlins. Then was a member of the Nationals in 2009. And then just like was wandering in the baseball wilderness for 4 years before he made it back with the Rockies in 2013. He's still playing in the minors for Tacoma. He's been great this year for Tacoma. But he was with us in Altoona in 2012. And the Pirates require minor leaguers to do a certain amount of community service. And he hadn't done his stuff. So we just made him record a whole bunch of promos for nonprofits for the video board. So we just, for like an hour and a half one day, sat with Logan Kensing. We were like, read this one.
That's awesome.
He's a super nice dude. Like Logan Kensing. But yeah, I guess
we can give it to old
Frankie.
I think he's a...
Remember how
Frankie's
exciting Frankie
having
was?
A pretty good career after leaving the old Colorado Rockies. Yeah.
Shocker.
This year for Kansas City, 48 games at 2.58 ERA. Not striking out any guys, but he's only walked 12 in 45 and a third innings. That's the lowest
Franklin
walk rate of his
Morales.
Career by about a full walk per nine innings.
Franklin Miguel Morales was the number 8 prospect in baseball, according to Baseball America, going into 2008. And in his Rockies career, 13-20, 5.10 ERA, 1.57 WHIP.
Yeah, that's pretty much about right.
214 strikeouts.
He walked nearly 5 batters per 9 innings.
Yep. FIP was exactly 5.10, the same as his ERA.
Which is actually pretty tough to do. That means you were exactly the pitcher
that
you claimed to be. The Rockies got exactly what they bargained for.
Thing.
There's no luck involved in Franklin Morales' life.
It is is.
You look at his whole career, though. His whole career, his ERA and his FIP are almost identical in pretty much every single season. Just kind of fascinating. A career ERA of 4.51, a career FIP of 4.67. That's kind of fascinating, actually.
Oh,
he really is all he is. That's just him. And by the way, he's only 29 years old.
It's ridiculous.
He's 29 years old.
Oh, my God.
Franklin Morales should be, like, LaTroy Hawkins' age, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely you should.
My God, he's only 29.
Oh, Lord. Welcome to the Franklin Morales Memorial Edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. Tyler Mon, Anthony Masterson. We're into that stretch of the season where I don't even know what to talk about. We already have our guest planned for next week, because we're going to talk a little non-on-the-field Rockies baseball.
Yeah.
Matt Replinger, who is a good pal of the podcast, a Denver baseball historian, Colorado baseball historian. Also, you can find on Twitter at MLB Yoga Guru, and he does work with 25-man rosters for a bunch of teams on yoga and strength training that way and all that kind of stuff. We're going to talk about that because it's one of those new trends in baseball that guys are really into, and kind of what it means for athletes, what it means for guys over the course of a season. We'll talk with Rep next week. This week,
nope, just not a really good team. I think we have to start with.
Where should we start?
Because we got to start with the best thing that happened to the Rockies this week, and that was John Gray's appearance on Monday at Citi Field. That was.
Yes.
Sure.
The only good thing that happened to the Rockies this week.
Yes. Unless the Rockies currently on this road trip are 2-4. The starters have an ERA of 3.63, which is not bad, but individually their record is 0-3, so pitcher wins. John Gray had one of the most encouraging outings, maybe in the history of the Colorado Rockies starting pitching rotation. I mean,
yeah.
There's no words that can really describe how much the Rockies needed John Gray to put together that kind of start early in his career, and he came through in his second start. Gave up just one run, a solo home run to Travis d'Arnaud. That was the only hit he gave up in 6 innings of work. He struck out 5. He walked 2. He used only 75 pitches to get through 6 innings. And then was summarily pulled from the game. And what happened after that, Tyler Mon? Say it with me. The bullpen. Yeah.
The Rockies bullpen happened. Give me your take on, you know, because we've already seen the, this organization's so stupid, how can they, blah, 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 John Gray, yada, yada. Okay, 2 things. One, every organization
Correct.
Has pitch limits, has innings limits, to certain extents, to certain parts of seasons with their guys. Look at what the Nationals did with Steven Strasburg in the middle of a playoff race.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shut him down because of an innings limit. And that worked out well. But two, I am on the stance that I understand the innings limit. I don't understand the pitch
limit. I
am
the opposite, actually.
Give me
your
thoughts on this, and we'll talk
about
it.
Well, because innings can be very, very different from inning to inning. You can throw 6 pitches in an inning and get through it, or you can throw 30 pitches in an inning and get through it. So I don't think it's as much an innings limit, because if John Gray, like he was on Monday in Citi Field, where he went through 6 innings on 75 pitches, you know, that's one of the better ratios the Rockies have had this season by a starting pitcher. I'm sure probably is the best, if I had to guess. So in that respect, I would say that pitches are more important than innings. If John Gray can get to the 9th inning and 90 pitches and his pitch limit or whatever is 100, then fine. Then put him out there then. But if you cap it off at an innings limit and say, well, he's only going to go 6 innings, or, you know, or blank amount of pitches, whatever. They're not going to leave him out there for 140 pitches if he's going to go 6 innings. If it's like, oh, he's only going to go 6 innings. Well, if he's there at 75 pitches, when this whole season in AAA, he's gone at least 80 pitches in all but one of his starts. He's gone 90 pitches a number of times, and he's gone 100 pitches 5 times this year in AAA.
He's got 90 plus right. 12 out of his 21 outings this year. And, yeah, and 100
so,
plus
in that respect,
5 times.
John Gray has put together a durable resume this season. He's been able to go deep into ballgames, and not even just go deep into ballgames, he's been able to throw a lot of pitches in ballgames and still be effective. So the 75 pitches that he threw in his second start this year, the second fewest he's thrown in any start this season. It was his last start in AAA. Against Salt Lake City in that rain-shortened game, he went through 70 pitches in 5 innings. So that doesn't really make any sense to me. I think the pitch limit, you want to say, like, okay, well, You're going to throw 90 pitches in this game, John. Okay, well, he could have gone through 7 and 90 pitches in the last game. And the seventh inning is when it all went to hell for the Rockies. So, obviously, that's hindsight, and who cares about wins and losses at this point? The Rockies are not going nowhere. But I don't think it'd be smart to cap him off at 6 innings. If he'd have been, like, at 50 pitches through 6 innings, you're going to cap him off at 6 innings? No. Like, I think that is a little bit more iffy in my respect, that I don't think they should have gone through that. I think they should have gone through pitches, say, like, hey, you get 90 pitches this game, see how many innings you can get.
Let me explain. We're going to talk about this with Jason Hirsch of Root Sports in about 10 minutes or so. So we'll get his take kind of on the whole, the pitches versus the innings limit, et cetera. But my thing is, if you were going to have John Gray on a pitch count limit, why was that not imposed season-long? I guess I just don't get why 3 weeks ago it's okay for him to throw 93 pitches in AAA. Now it's only okay for him to throw 75 pitches at the major league level. I get...
Right, exactly.
I get not wanting to burn the guy out. I get if you want to cap him at 100 pitches. That makes perfect sense.
Sure.
And I know that you don't want to burn a guy out toward the end of a season when you're not playing for anything, whatever. But I don't understand the logic behind, especially when it's such a good outing. It's such a, you know, and yeah. Yes, and he gets to leave with a good taste in his mouth and a good outing under his belt, but dude goes out and throws a one-hitter over 6 innings. He's only at 75 pitches. I'm sure everybody in that stadium was like, wait, what the hell? Why is that great kid out?
The Mets broadcasters were flummoxed.
I had I have a really good friend who works on the Mets media relations staff, and he texted me the next day, why did you guys put Gray on a pitch count of 65? He was mowing us down like a lawnmower, like a riding lawnmower, not even a push mower, like a brand new John Deere. He was big on the mower metaphor. But yeah. I completely get the innings limit. I get that you don't want to burn the kid past 100 pitches, whatever it is. But to have let him gone, there was a stretch from May 15th through July 7th in which John Gray threw 96 or more pitches in all but one outing. So I don't get why at AAA it's okay for him to reach these pitch counts, and in the major leagues it's not. And maybe it has something to do with the fact that John Gray is not throwing over 90 pitches in 3 weeks or so, but dude's not going to break. I mean, this kid, it's not from a pitch count that you're going to see an issue with John Gray. He threw a ton of pitches in college. The Rockies obviously have managed that very well since he's coming to pro ball.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's
it. Could be.
But yes,
I get the innings thing. I don't get the in-game pitch count thing when it's that low. That's what confuses me.
Exactly. It would have made a lot more sense to let him go out there for the seventh, and then if he gets to 90 pitches, which I'm assuming is somewhere around where the actual pitch count is, then you can go and get him, you know, middle of the inning or whatever. But I'm sure they wanted to leave him with a good taste in his mouth. I totally understand that. But at the same time, come on. 75 pitches in 6 innings, that's a ratio that is unseen for the Colorado Rockies
starting
staff.
And it's what they
want to
see
year.
From him. You know, like that was the whole thing. When he was in AAA toward the end of his time in AAA, was John Gray's got to be more efficient. And then he's efficient. He's brilliant. And his second major league start, it's like, all right, kid, hit the showers.
Yeah. What? You did good, kid. We'll take it from here. Boone Logan's going, all right, what is this? It's a fire? Okay, I got some gasoline. I'm going to come in here and just go.
By the way, it's Boone Logan's birthday today. And Boone Logan's only 31, which means that Boone Logan and I have been the same age for the last like 8 weeks or so. And that kind of makes me feel gross.
Boone Logan getting a 3-year deal is still completely
Boone Logan has made like $19 million in his major league career, by the way. And he's on the hook for $6.5 million next year. The Rockies are on the hook with that.
He's setting fire to that pile of money.
Me and Boone Logan, who have combined to live on this earth for 61 years, one of us has been very successful. Boone Logan.
I was going to say, which one?
Not me, yeah. Shockingly. but so I just, you know, I see both sides of it. Obviously, the only thing you can do if you're the Rockies is keep the kid on a limit of some kind. Make sure you're not going to burn him out, et cetera. Yeah. I get fans who are frustrated, want to see John Gray go out, throw 97, bury a team over 8 innings. I get that. That's, you know, that's what fans do. That's what you're supposed to do. It's a big tease.
Especially because we had not seen that from anybody in the starting rotation
and
all year.
It's injected some energy. I mean, the Rockies, you know, John Gray will be on the mound Saturday, and that's exciting. It's exciting to have that now to look forward to. It's about the only exciting thing of this team lately, but it's exciting. Now,
yeah, he'll be faced off with Andrew Cashman. Yeah. That'll be a fun game at Coors Field.
Now, this was somewhat cleared up this week. Walt Weiss told Nick Roque of the Denver Post, I believe last week, that the Rockies didn't want to go much more than 20-25% over what John Gray threw last year with Double A Tulsa, which was 124 1/3 innings. But Jeff Breidich has now come out and said that it's a little bit more flexible than that. He told Thomas Harding of MLB.com, quote, "We're not talking about a magic number. We're just going to be intelligent. The process started prior to him getting to the big league level. We're just going to continue to manage his workload." And that makes sense. I get the innings limit. I get not wanting to put that much mileage on a kid's arm in a season where you're not going anywhere. What I don't get is the limit in games.
Yes. And that's why – that was my point with the pitches versus innings limit, you know. That's where you need to cap it there. You need to cap it at a pitch limit in a game instead of an innings limit. And that was, you know, like I said, last year, only 124 1/3 innings. He's already passed that now, or about that now, with his two starts in the big – I think he'd actually just passed it. So
threw 114 in Albuquerque, and he has now thrown 10 in the big
league. And he's thrown out 10. He's exactly at where he was last year with his innings limit in Tulsa, or innings pitched in Tulsa.
And he was
last
shut down.
Year.
He made, I believe, one postseason appearance. Actually, he was shut down before the playoffs. Kyle Freeland made one postseason appearance, but Gray last year was shut down prior to the playoffs. Tulsa went to the Texas League Championship.
So every pitch he makes going forward will be a career high in innings for him, which
That's
is good.
Great.
That's what you want to do. You want to be able to increase your innings every single year for a pitcher, for a young kid, you know, still only 23 years old. You want to be able to get him maybe 20, 25 more innings this year.
Now, that being said, John Gray, it's not like he's a real stranger to this. In his junior season at Oklahoma, when the Rockies took him with the third overall pick, he threw 126 1/3 that year, and then followed, and that's just in college, and then followed that up with 37 1/3 professional innings. So it's not like he has never gone out and had a workload like this. But I completely understand the Rockies wanting to limit, keep him healthy, you know, as I've now said 17 times. I just don't get it in games. It'd be one thing if they had, you know, all season long, John Gray's not going to go past this perimeter. And then they did, and they let him come back, and now he's stuck at a lower threshold. That kind of confuses me. I don't know, man.
Yep.
I don't know. I mean, obviously, have no expertise. But it seemed odd.
Let's just call it what it is right now. And that was one of the most encouraging starts we've seen a Rocks pitcher ever make. In terms of what John Gray did, 6 innings, 1 hit, 5 Ks, 1 earned run. That's only been done twice in the last 2 seasons. Jorge De La Rosa did it against the Padres last May.
Whoa.
And then Jolie Chacin did it against the Giants back in August of 2013.
Whoa.
That's it. Those only 2 times it's happened in the last 3 years before John Gray did it against the Mets on Monday.
Ugh.
Yeah. It's a fun list, though, looking at people who have gone 6 innings, allowed 1 or fewer hits, struck out 5 or more, and allowed 1 or fewer earned runs. It's a good list for the Rockies. Let's see. Ubaldo's done it 3 times, including the no-hitter, of course. Jolice has done it twice. DLR has done it twice. And then the list of guys who've done it once: John Gray, Jason Jennings, Joe Kennedy. Curtis Laskanik, Rodrigo Lopez, our boy Frankie Morales, Denny Nagel, Drew Pomeranz, and Denny Stark.
Wow. By the way, did you see the abuse that Jolie Chacin took in his last start for AAA Reno?
128 pitches
over 7 2/3.
It's okay. He's been durable his whole career and never been hurt once.
That was insane.
He's never had arm problems.
Tacoma's radio guy Mike Curto tweeted out, "I don't think I've ever seen a AAA pitcher throw 128 pitches, but Jolie Chacin just did it." And Chacin's been great for Reno.
He's been awesome.
Another guy who is 27, by the way, Jolie Chacin.
That's not true.
But 5.3, 3.36 ERA, struck out 51, walked 24, and 64 1/3. But, you know, has not been bad for Reno at all. And at this point, and this is a topic for another podcast, but would the Rockies really have been worse off having Chacin in the rotation instead of Kyle Kendrick?
Absolutely not.
You know what I mean? Like,
well, I mean, I think the getting rid of Julie Chassin was more of an indictment.
I think
on
it was a
Julie
yeah.
Chassin
I think you're
anything.
Right.
I think,
and I think it was a cultural issue. I think the Rockies wanted to put a stamp on. I think Jeff Bridges wanted to put a stamp on. You got to work to be here, and I don't think they were impressed.
That's
with,
the thing.
With what Chassin had been doing.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Like there was not a lot of effort coming from Jolisa's side. From what we've heard, there was not a lot of effort coming from Jolie Chassin's side in order to get back and get healthy right away. And I think, you know, they eventually just ran out of patience with him. Understandable. You know, guy needs a fresh start. He got one. And he's been with a couple of teams here. He's with the Indians, AAA affiliate for a while. Now he's with the Diamondbacks. So good for him. I hope he does well. I'm sure he'll come back into Rockies and throw, you know, seven one-hit innings or something like that.
Absolutely,
so
he will. So that's been fun. But you know, two things. One, yes, it's going to be frustrating that we're all going to be teased with John Gray and we have to wait until next year to really see John Gray as John Gray. But two, man, it injects some life and some energy and some excitement into things. And that's really cool.
Every fifth day
since we've had that.
Every fifth day you can go out and say, okay, well, I'm going to go see John Gray pitch today. And that is awesome.
He's so fun. He is so
fun. He is
fun.
Like, he looked awesome. He attacked the zone with ferocity. Like, he was not throwing anything outside the zone. He didn't miss a single spot, I think, until the third inning. And it was mostly just fastballs. And the one fastball that Travis d'Arnaud did hit out, it was a fastball down the middle trying to get ahead because he'd been throwing a lot of fastballs early in counts, and d'Arnaud jumped on it, hit a home run. That's going to happen. You know, what I liked the most out of John Gray's performance was in the fifth inning when he got a couple runners on and was facing Curtis Granderson. There was a wild pitch. There was an error behind him. And a young kid like that, making only a second big league start on the road, could have gotten a little flustered, kind of let things get away from him. But with Curtis Granderson at the plate, a very good hitter, having a good season, on a 3-1 count, he made a great pitch, a fastball up in the zone. Granderson couldn't get his hands up on top of it enough, and he just popped it up to the infield and got out of the inning. And that was, I think, the biggest moment of that entire start for me for John Gray, was getting Granderson on that pop-up with two outs and two men on, with only up by a run. So, and then he came back up for the sixth and got, you know, dispatched the Mets summarily as well. So John Gray showed so many good things that we really want to see from a lot of these starting pitchers going forward. And, you know, you wish someone like Eddie Butler could have taken what John Gray did to heart. Butler today, he's having, an Eddie Butler start. We're seeing a lot of good things, seeing a lot of bad things. Eddie Butler today is hitting 97 with regularity, which is good. But he's also being punished for every mistake he's made, which is bad. He's giving up a lot of hard contact on pitches that are right in the middle of the zone when he's forced to throw in there when he's behind in the count. But you see the good, you see the bad from Eddie Butler. You take them both, and then you have the facts of life. But,
oh,
you know,
man.
You do wish that, you know, of course, like, we say this a lot. It sucks that we have to say this a lot. But
that should be the title of this podcast.
It sucks that we have to say this a lot, but your Colorado Rockies podcast. These guys aren't trying to suck.
No.
Eddie Butler's not trying to suck.
Eddie
John
Butler's
Axford's not
24.
Trying to suck.
Yeah, how much I sucked at things in my professional life when I was 24.
Yeah, like a lot of things.
You know,
you still haven't figured that out yet.
I was in Myrtle, and I'm sure I was not that good of a play-by-play guy my first year, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think I was better than the guy I worked with, but I, you know, whatever.
Oh.
By the way, did you see
what
the,
do you mean, Tyler?
Did you see the story I tweeted out about Butter and his dogs?
I did not.
Go read it. It's awesome. There's a story in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution about the guy who was there. We're just basically – somebody once gave us a review on iTunes where they said we sound like two drunk guys talking Rockies baseball in a bar.
That's probably about
That's
right.
pretty much what it is. And I just started talking to you like we're just having a conversation. People are listening in on it. Oh, you know that guy we used to work with? But anyway, guy we
did
used
you
to
see,
work with.
There was an E60 thing a couple days ago on Rookie and Derby, the Trenton Thunder bet.
No way!
Oh, it was
– awesome.
It was heart-wrenching. It's talking about Chase, the original, the OG Bat Dog who passed away a couple years ago.
I love the Miners, man. Went to Grand Junction. We'll talk about that later on in the show. We're going to talk more pitching, and we're going to do it with a guy who's had success at Coors Field, knows what it takes. Jason Hirsch, former Rockies starter and current Root Sports analyst, joins the show to talk a little Rockies pitching in the next chapter of this staff next. We're going to pull back the curtain on the Purple Dinosaur podcast and inform you that this is the not the first interview that we have done with Jason Hirsch over the last 2 days. But hey, welcome back to the show, former Rockies pitcher, current Root Sports analyst, Jason Hirsch. Hey, buddy.
Wow, this is like deja vu. I think I've done this book before.
So yesterday, we talked to Jason for like a half hour. It was like awesome, insightful. Anthony and I had like a run of text messages during the interview, like, man, this is so good. And then hang up the call. And it did not record in the Skype to MP3 recorder that I use, despite the fact that while we were doing the call, it said recording on recording a call. It did not record the call. So that was very
exciting. That's what happens for using old technology.
I use a Commodore 64. Is that weird? Is that a weird
you can't
thing?
Do that. Floppy disks don't work thing? Anymore, dude. They don't even make 5.5-inch floppy like readers.
What were the other ones called that weren't the floppy disk, but they were the smaller, like the, you know?
They were still, I think, floppier. They were still, I think, floppy disks. They're like 3.5-inch floppy.
Yeah, 3.5-inch.
5.5-inch were the true floppies, and then the ones with the little, like, silver sliding door on them.
Yeah, that
I
one.
I think those were still floppies.
We're going down a rabbit hole right here.
The 5.5-inch ones, I think, were like what? Where in the world?
You're getting into my middle school / high school nerd days right now.
He was a 6'7" nerd in high school.
When I used to build computers and know all that.
Did you really?
Yeah, I was a little bit of a nerd when I was younger. I was really into technology, and I was fascinated with building things and pulling them apart and seeing how they worked.
So, at like whatever you were in high school, 6'8", and I would imagine like I don't know 220. You were a nerd building computers.
You were being very generous. Thank you very much for that.
Figured I'd take off 30. What were you in high school? Like 6'6", 130?
I was 200 when I graduated high school. I was 6'8", 260.
Oh my God! Were you really?
I was a floppy 260.
Wow! What was your playing weight in the big leagues?
Yeah. I think 250, 255. It just kind of depended on the day and what I ate and if I took a dump in the morning.
6'8", 260 in high school is like, holy cow. Human being. That's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I was a big boy. I was a pretty thick kid, too. That's actually why I wanted to go to ASU, like, in the worst way out of high school, and they were interested, but they didn't like that I was a floppy 260, so they wanted me to go to JUCO and kind of clean it up a little bit.
And you're
bit.
Building computers in your spare time. You're like, all right,
and,
nerd.
Yeah,
I don't know about this.
Yeah, I was a huge nerd, but that's a whole other story
well,
for
Jason,
another day.
It's okay. My girlfriend went to University of Arizona, so she would say not going to ASU is the best thing you ever did with your entire life.
Yeah, but the U of A is down in the armpit of America in Tucson.
She would have forbidden us from having your podcast.
My uncle always said he went to ASU. He goes, if America got a colonoscopy, the tube would go in through Tucson.
Oh, those are, we're going to have some serious – now, our Twitter feed is going to blow up now. Nicole's going to be furious. You can't have him on the podcast anymore.
Yeah, Nicole's going to be mad about that.
Well, all right. Let's try to recreate some podcasting magic from yesterday. We were recording yesterday when Eddie Butler was starting to struggle in that start, and his final line ended up 4 innings, 7 hits, 6 runs, gave up a homer. He walked one batter. He struck out 4. That's the positive thing, the walks and strikeout ratio. But this season has been confounding with Eddie Butler because, as Anthony noted yesterday, dude's touching 97 miles an hour. His stuff has good run and sink. He's got great movement on all of his pitches, but he doesn't seem to have the mentality, the focus, the confidence in his stuff to get outs. And what exactly have you seen as the issue with Eddie Butler this year, Jason?
Yeah, Eddie's got great stuff, and I think there's no doubt that you know, he was being the one of the top pitching prospects. Everyone was really excited when he came up, and the Rockies may have rushed him a little bit and didn't quite give him enough, you know, seasoning at the lower levels. But you know, when Eddie's good, he's on top of his pitches. He gets downhill movement. Everything moves. You know, everything runs arm side. His slider's pretty nasty when he can throw it for strikes. The problem with Eddie comes when he flattens everything out, and it happens a lot. He's not fooling anybody. You know, 97 used to be pretty good at fooling guys, but when it's flat, it's in the zone, guys tee off on it, especially big league hitters. And so Eddie's had some issues, I think, just maintaining, repeating the mechanics, trying to get on top of the baseball. And he prides everything that he does on movement, right? Everything that you talk to Eddie in the locker room, talk to him out on the field, he's like, everything I throw moves. I'm like, that's great, Eddie. but why don't we just throw it down the middle and let it run to a corner or let it dive into a left-handed hitter? I think he's been cherry-picking the zone a lot. And by that, I mean, he's trying to throw to an edge. Like, he's afraid to let somebody hit it. And that's kind of what you see out of a young guy who maybe doesn't trust his stuff quite enough yet. Doesn't have that same mentality that, you know, maybe a John Gray has shown in his first two starts, where he just attacks hitters in the zone. And I think having, you know, a guy like John Gray up there, you know, Eddie and John are good buddies, and maybe, you know, having Johnny Gray up there will kind of motivate Eddie to be a little bit better, to kind of have somebody to go along with the struggles along with him. You know, yesterday we saw an increase in velocity that we haven't seen a whole lot out of Eddie this year. I think his average fastball, like you guys had mentioned yesterday, was like 93. We saw him touching 97 yesterday. That's kind of John Gray territory. So maybe having these two guys together would be good. But, you know, right now it really is a conundrum. I know Rockies fans, I'm sure Eddie is just as frustrated with his performances going out there. He's got a 5.9 ERA now, and that's not what you want out of your prospect.
So, Jason, one of the other big things we've seen that has been the problem with Eddie Butler this season was maybe the lack of separation and velocity between his fastball and his changeup. His fastball averages around 93.4 miles an hour, changeup around 87.3, so about a 6-mile-an-hour difference. Now, you're looking at more of an 8, 9, 10-mile-an-hour difference of your changeup. And just for example, John Gray has come up in his first two starts. His average fastball is 95.2, changeup 86.3. So that's the separation velocity you want. But even though Eddie Butler's stuff is so good, does it really matter if he can't separate that fastball and the changeup in a hitter's mind as well?
Well, yeah, what you're doing is you see two pitches that are very similar to each other in that 5 to 6 mile an hour range, whereas as a major league hitter, the adjustment for 4 to 5 miles an hour is not very much, right? You can hold back just long enough to time up that pitch and make contact with it. When you have that 9, 10, 11 mile an hour difference, you're talking about, sorry, my kids just came in and started having war, distracting me from my answer. When you have that 10 mile an hour difference, it's enough for a guy to get out on his front foot, miss the pitch, allows it to drop a little bit. And with Eddie Butler, you know, even when his pitches are flat, if he had that change in separation, you'd have a hitter out on his front foot. You'd be able to throw that hard fastball and put him on his back foot, and you'd have that rocking motion of forwards and backwards. But when the pitches are so close together, you don't have that opportunity to rock them. They can just sit in the box and be comfortable. And you couple that with the fact that Eddie Butler's pitches are flat, they're not moving downhill, and all of a sudden hitters are basically having batting practice with a small variation in velocity. So that's one thing I know when they sent him down to AAA to work on stuff was to help get some variation in those pitches. And has it worked? You know, I don't think we've seen it quite yet. It might be something that he has to really work on in the offseason, whether it's Steve Foster or Darren Holmes gives him something to work on, or he sticks around in Denver or goes to them, wherever they may spend their offseason, and spend some time with him working on that variation in pitch. And they might just be letting him ride out this season, just get the experience, and then say, you know what, take it into the offseason, really work hard on it, and come into spring training ready to compete for a spot in the rotation. Because right now I don't think it's a given that next year Eddie Butler would be one of your top five starters. You know, granted, we don't really know who would be that top five other than maybe De La Rosa and potentially a John Gray. But I think for Eddie Butler, that there's still a lot to be desired there. I think that the raw tools are there. We can see that. But we just haven't seen the execution yet. I don't know if that's a mental thing for him or if it's a physical repeatability in his mechanics thing. And that's something for Foster and Holmes to figure out.
Is there an easy solution, Jason, to getting that separation velocity to increase a little bit? Is it just backing off the pitch a little bit? Is it, you know, shortening stride, elongating a stride? Is it something mechanical?
Yeah, it could be mechanical. You definitely don't want to back off a pitch. You don't want to slow your arm down because that telegraphs it to the hitter. You know, he's gonna see that arm slow down. He's gonna know right away that's not a fastball anymore. The way I teach kids, and maybe it's something Eddie Butler does, it's just a variation in the grip. Maybe he puts the ball further back in his palm to kind of cut off the velocity. Maybe he holds it a little bit looser in his fingertips. It could be a pronation of the wrist. Maybe he's not turning his wrist over enough on the changeup. You know, if he throws a circle change, maybe it's let's just find a whole different grip altogether. You know, there's a bunch of different ways to throw changeups. You know, De La Rosa doesn't throw a circle change, but he throws a split finger, and that's kind of his changeup. It's enough off his fastball that and you get the movement that he can get guys to swing and miss. So for Eddie, yeah, it's there's a whole bunch of different options in there that they can try. I don't know what they've done yet or so far, but it's definitely something to consider. You know, kind of playing around with the grips, and I'm sure that they've done a little bit of that. And it, for pitchers, it always comes down to comfort level. How comfortable am I with that grip? Because if I'm not comfortable with it, I'm not going to trust it when I throw it. If he can feel like he's throwing a fastball with a slightly different grip and get that 8 to 10 velocity drop, then he's going to be in a good place. But right now, we just don't see that.
Jason, when you look at a guy like Eddie Butler or even some of the other guys that we've seen struggle coming up and sticking and having major league success, namely Tyler Matzek, I want to ask you a question about the way that guys like this develop and maybe some of the reasons behind these struggles, because I think the Rockies have placed an emphasis on having, you know, obviously character guys is a big thing for a long time, but the Rockies have very intelligent guys on this roster. A lot of the dudes that they have, especially on the pitching staff, are really, really bright guys. And I think that sometimes harms you in baseball because you're so hyper aware of what goes on when you struggle. And then you just let that compound, and that continues to snowball and roll on you. And I think with Tyler Matzek, that's certainly one of the cases. But I know if, with Matzek, for example, he's a Mike Marshall kid. He got into the organization. He didn't necessarily get to develop the way that he did as an amateur pitcher coming up and into the draft. With Eddie Butler, I have a friend who's on a coaching staff at Radford University. Some of the baseball coaches there have said his arm slot is totally different as a professional now than what it was in college when he was very successful. For some of these guys, Does the ability to not be able to kind of reset themselves after struggles, is that what kills a lot of these prospects? How do you get a guy mentally prepared to succeed as well as what he has in his physical tools? Because I feel like with a lot of these guys that the Rockies have, that's half the battle. Sometimes mentally it's just not there because that continues to eat away at them.
Yeah, we have a saying in the baseball world called paralysis by analysis, meaning you tend to overthink things when things start going wrong. You start to think about mechanics instead of just trying to be athletic. When I was down in AAA for a little bit, we had a catcher who was a non-roster guy, but just he was our bullpen catcher, and I was throwing a bullpen one day, and you know, I was struggling with my command, and I was in that same mode of that paralysis by analysis. And it tends to happen with guys who are very analytical, very, you know, heady, if you will. They're smart kids. They're not your, you know, dumb athlete or whatever. And so we used to have the saying that, you know, when I was throwing this bullpen, it's called pitch stupid, meaning just whatever the finger gets put down, just think, I'm going to throw this pitch as hard as I can to that spot and just let my athletic ability, my talent, my mechanics, let all that stuff just take over naturally and not think, well, I've got to stay on my backside. I've got to get my front side elevated. I got to get my fingers around this pitch to throw, to add depth to it. And I think when guys start having those thoughts where they're thinking about how to throw the pitch instead of thinking about just throwing it, you tend to dig yourself into a deep hole. Now, guys like Tyler Matzek, for example, he's a smart kid, right? He has that paralysis by analysis where he might be overthinking things. But this is also a kid, don't forget, when he came out of high school in Southern California, he was, you know, throwing mid to upper 90s. He's left-handed. How many high school kids do you know that can handle the kind of stuff that Tyler Matzek was probably throwing up there? The guy probably never faced any adversity in high school, never a kid or a player who could turn his pitch around. And he got away with a lot of things. All of a sudden, he gets into pro ball, and this was a big shock from when I got there, was, hey, everybody throws 95, 96, and guess what? The hitters up there, they eat 95 and 96 for breakfast. And so you have to really start making adjustments, and we saw early in Tyler Matzek's career, you know, the Rockies sent him back home to work with his high school coach because he was in a bad place. And he figured it out. He mentally got right. He made his rise through the system. And he came up, and he was really good for the Rockies at the end of last season. Unbelievable arm. I think there was a lot of promise in him. He comes into spring training, and for whatever reason, he lost that confidence. He started thinking too much about what he was doing and how to do it instead of just going out there and being athletic. And he dug himself into another hole to the point where the Rockies, again, had to send him home to work with, you know, somebody that he was familiar or comfortable with. And so A lot of pitchers have that issue, and when you're smart, it comes down to between your ears instead of just thinking about being athletic. And I think that's a big problem with a lot of players, and I know that's a big part of this game, especially nowadays with all the stress and pressures and the money and stuff that's involved in it, is you tend to get in your head too much and stop doing what got you there in the first place. Eddie Butler might have had a different arm slot in college, but you know, he was a certain player in college, and when he gets into the pro level, guys start tinkering with him. They want to put their stamp on you and say, "I'm the one who made Eddie Butler a big league pitcher," or "I'm the one who did this," or "I'm the one who did that." And next thing you know, you've got a guy who, when he got into pro ball, was an athlete, and then you get him into pro ball, and now he's a thinker. He's a philosopher. We don't want philosophers on the mound. We want athletes on the mound. And so, at the end of the day, for those guys, it just comes down to that, like I said, that saying, pitch stupid, just go out there and do what got you there in the first place. And I think if guys did that, if guys really trusted their stuff and just went out there and stopped thinking, they'd probably have more good games than they had bad games.
Now let's shift to a guy who pitched pretty stupid on Monday for the Rockies, John Gray. Second start for the team, one hit. It was a Travis d'Arnaud home run in six innings, gave up just the one run, struck out five. What did you see from John Gray that got you excited moving forward?
I think there's a lot to look at and see with John Gray that can get a lot of Rockies fans excited. You saw a guy on Monday who finished his pitches a little bit better than he finished in that first game. We saw the game in Seattle at Coors Field, or against Seattle at Coors Field, that he was kind of pulling up a little bit on his pitches, standing up, not finishing them. He was up in the zone, fell behind a lot of hitters, and that's generally not a good recipe for success. What we saw in New York on Monday was a guy finishing his pitches, attacking the zone with 95 to 97. We saw a guy who was down in the zone and going after hitters. And I think, you know, for a guy like John Gray, when you're a power arm like that, you throw 95, 97, and you trust your stuff. When you throw it with conviction like he did on Monday, you get big league hitters to take some really bad swings. You couple that with a changeup that's a plus pitch for him. It's got some vertical movement and a wipeout slider. There's a lot to like right there. 75 pitches through six innings. You know, the two walks, that's, you know, part of being a young pitcher. But I think he made some great adjustments from his first outing at Coors to the second outing in New York. And I think this third outing is going to be really kind of that telltale now, because the other team's going to have two games worth of video to watch him. They're going to have a scouting report on him. There's going to be some tendencies that developed over those first two games. And you might see this next outing against San Diego, you might see hitters start to ambush him early in the counts because they figured he's a power guy. He's going to attack his own with fastballs early, so that's what they're going to look at. And it's going to be up to him and Nick Hundley or Mike McKinnon, whoever's catching him that day, to make those adjustments. Maybe he starts pitching him backwards, but he's going to have to start kind of developing himself and understanding how hitters are reacting to his pitches. But what we saw on Monday was very, very promising for the organization to have a power arm like that come up and make an impact right away.
Jason, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, and obviously, you know, we're two guys who haven't pitched in pro ball and haven't worked in player development, but there's something about John Gray's start to things with the Rockies that has left us a little bit confounded. The Rockies lifted him after a brilliant performance against the Mets, six innings, that one hit, just the homer, struck out five, walked two, but he only threw 75 pitches, and they took him out after 77 pitches in his debut. With all the energy and the adrenaline that go into that, you can kind of understand it a little bit more so in your first outing, but to go just 75 pitches in that second game, the Rockies have talked about increasing his innings workload 20 to 25% over what we saw last year. And then Jeff Breidich said it's not even necessarily that. It's not even a set number. They're just working on a workload that they feel like will benefit him this year. But the pitch count limit in starts seems a little strange to me, because in 12 of his 21 minor league outings, he threw over 90 pitches, and in five of them, he threw over 100. So to throw a kid out there who has had, you know, workhorse starts this season, and then all of a sudden have to back him down on pitch count in games seems weird. Does that seem kind of strange to you? The innings limit seems to make sense, but the pitch count thing is weird.
Yeah, I think the word that you're looking for there is workload, and you mentioned it earlier as you were talking. There's a difference between throwing 75 pitches in six innings and 75 pitches in three or four innings. There's a different kind of workload. When you're only throwing 10 or 12 pitches an inning versus when you're throwing 20 pitches an inning, there's a lot more stress on that arm. It's a stressful situation. What we saw John Gray on Monday was a guy who wasn't stressed hardly at all, had very few base runners. I think he had probably two the whole game. you know, the, just off the walks. But you saw a guy who was very comfortable. He had very good body language. He didn't look like he was struggling. He didn't look like he was sweating. He was just reaching back and firing, and that's a real easy workload on the arm. The body tends to recover a lot better when you have easy games like that. Now, the first game that he threw that 30-pitch inning, that's a heavy workload on the arm. That's a lot of stress. You're out there for a very long time executing your pitch and putting the forces and velocities on the body for an extended period of time. And after that game, you know, the body recovers differently when you have a high stress load versus when you have a low stress load. And so what I think the Rockies are trying to do is just minimize that stress load on the body. This is probably the longest he's ever thrown in his career, the most amount of innings. I don't necessarily think it's the pitch count that they're looking at. It's more the innings load. How many times is he getting up and sitting down and getting up and sitting down? How many times is he doing that? This is a longer season than he's used to. You know, he's been throwing since February, and here we are in August, you know, almost clicking over to September, and they're going to try and monitor how many innings John Gray throws, because they don't want to stress that body too much to the point where it starts to shut down or starts to fatigue to the point where something might go. He might get injured, and that's the worst-case scenario for the Rockies, to have a guy like him get injured. So they're going to kind of baby him a little bit. Obviously, he'll understand what that workload's like. His body will respond, and he'll take according, you know, steps in the offseason to strengthen and condition his body for that extended workload, because next year he's going to be expected to go out there and potentially throw 200 innings as a starter. But do I agree with pitch limits and pitch or inning limits? Yeah, to an extent, I understand it. I get their point is this is their baby. He's their first, you know, real power arm to come up in a long time. He's the future of the pitching franchise. And I don't necessarily, like I said, agree with it. I feel like if a guy's going good, let him go. You know, the difference between 75 and 100 pitches, you're talking 25 pitches. That might be one more inning, maybe two more innings. And at the end of the day, that shows that he can go deep into ball games. It kind of teaches him another aspect of being a pitcher at the big league level. But at the same time, I understand what the organization is doing. They're trying to be careful with him. They don't want to blow him out. They know that they have something. They're not playing for anything right now. They're too many games out of the division, out of the wild card, that the season really doesn't mean anything at this point. So it's meaningless for him to go out there and potentially blow out just for the sake of, you know, letting him throw 100 pitches or letting him go 9 innings.
Yeah, you kind of said it, though, Jason. It was on Monday we kind of were seeing the future of the Rockies, and we've seen an organizational shift in philosophy, really, especially in the last 3 weeks or so, that we got John Gray. He's already in the big leagues. You traded Troy Tulowitzki for some power arms like Jeff Hoffman, who's done very well so far in Double A. Miguel Castro, a hard-throwing reliever in Triple A right now. Jesus Tinoco had a great start last night for Asheville. And Kyle Freeland as well, on top of that, first-round pick last year. He had a 7 shutout innings last night in Modesto. Do you see this as an organizational shift for the Rockies, that they're trying to go with these power arms? Because we saw on Monday, it did kind of seem like we're looking at the future of the Colorado Rockies for better or for worse. You know, John Gray had a great start, and then the bullpen blew it. But is this kind of what you see happening in the future? The Rockies will try to go after these power arms and try to catch up with the rest of the league in terms of getting swings and misses?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the organizations for the last decade has tried sinker ball guys. They figured, you know, the ball flies at Coors Field. We don't want to give up home runs, so we're going to get guys that really focus on keeping the ball on the ground. And it really hasn't worked out well for them. They've been, you know, at or near the bottom of all of, you know, the pitching staffs in Major League Baseball for the last decade. So I think that was a failed experiment in bringing sinker ballers in. And I think, you know, what we saw with the arms that we got back in the Tulowitzki trade, they're all mid to upper 90s plus fastball arms. And John Gray, I think, is a good example of what can happen with a power arm. And I think even in Major League Baseball, we're seeing kind of a trend towards more and more guys that are throwing in that, you know, 95, 96 range. You know, roles have become so specialized that starters really only need to go 5 or 6 innings, and they've got guys that can bridge it to your closer. So for the Rockies to go out and get power arms like that for Troy Tulowitzki, especially young power arms, I think is definitely a sign of a shift in philosophy in the Jeff Breidich era of Rockies baseball. You're going to see more and more guys. They're going to target more and more guys in the draft who are power arms. You know, Jeff Hoffman, for example, was he was taken in the 9th overall slot last year, right behind Kyle Freeland. He was the very next pick. He was supposed to be the consensus number one, except he ended up having Tommy John. And the Blue Jays thought so well of him, that, of what he had, that they still drafted him 9th overall, knowing that he needed the surgery. And he's bounced back remarkably. He's had tremendous outings so far for the Rockies. He hasn't really skipped a beat since he's come over to this organization. And we can hopefully get to see him and Freeland and maybe Tinoco or whoever else comes up in the future. And I think what the Rockies are going to try and do is exactly what the Mets and the Astros have done over the last couple of years, is acquire arms, power arms, and try and get them to mature all at the same time. We saw the Mets do it. They started with Zach Wheeler, then they brought up Harvey. Now they've got Syndergaard and Mats and DeGrom, and you've got a core of young arms there. They're all in their early 20s. They all throw mid to upper 90s. They've all got unbelievable stuff. And so now you're going to see an organization like the Mets, who's going to dominate potentially for the next 5 or 6 years, because those guys are young, they're under control, but they're going to be the anchor of that staff. Houston's done the exact same thing. They've gone out and acquired some arms, and they've all kind of matured together. And I think it's no surprise that that organization, you know, 5 years ago, if you looked at Houston and said, do you think they're going to compete, you know, in 2015, you would have looked at them and said, hell no, these guys are terrible. They've got nothing in the farm. They've got nothing at the big league level. And now you look at them and you're like, wow, this team is for real. They've got plenty of arms. They've stayed healthy all year long. They've gone out there and competed. And they're at the top of the division that everybody thought that the Angels were going to run away with. So this is kind of the philosophy that I think Jeff Bridges and the organization has finally kind of adopted. They figured, you know, sinker ballers haven't worked over the last decade. Let's try power guys and see what happens. Because, you know, if it's better if the guy doesn't hit the ball than if he puts it on the ground. So you've got guys who've got power arms with wipeout stuff. The philosophy of the organization shifts towards that power arm, and you might start to see, you know, that the organization come around. You might start to see that pitching staff kind of start creeping out of that bottom part of the league and start moving its way into the mid part, because we all know that the Rockies are really good at developing hitters. They're going to have, you know, they replace one hitter when he leaves with another great hitter. So that's never been their problem, but it has been pitching, and they've acquired some good arms in that Tulo trade that can potentially, you know, springboard this organization towards, you know, a good 5, 6, 7 year run with some quality arms at the big league level.
Yeah. Here's a fun stat here. So the Mets have thrown from their starting rotation almost 1,000 more pitches at 95 miles an hour or more than the next closest team, the Indians. They've thrown over 3,000 pitches this season at 95 miles an hour or more. The Indians are right about 1,800.
And I think something really important to remember about that stat right there is they're all still healthy. Right. Not a single one of them has missed extended period of time this season for health issues. So if you got guys who are mid to upper 90s who are staying healthy all year long, that's definitely a recipe for success. We saw it in New York when the Rockies faced off against that staff. I mean, they're pretty much unhittable. And I think another interesting point to kind of point out is when you think about the three arms that we got back from Toronto, Noah Syndergaard went over to the Mets from Toronto as well.
Yeah.
So there's something over there in that Toronto organization. They're really good at picking out those mid to upper 90s guys that seem to have some really good stuff.
Yeah, but the Rockies on that list are the fourth fewest 95 mile an hour pitches from their starting staff. The Giants have only thrown 11 pitches at 95 miles an hour plus. The Rangers at 20,
and that's a completely, and that, you know, you look at the Giants, that's a completely different organizational philosophy when it comes to pitching. I mean, those guys they're more pitchers, right? But you also have to look at the ballpark that they're playing in, right? The ball doesn't really fly. It's really hard to hit something out of that ballpark. So they kind of, they understand where they play, and they understand the kind of pitcher that thrives in that environment, and they've targeted that player, and it's worked out well for them. You know, the Rockies have struggled the last 10 years with their organizational philosophy, so now they're going to try the other side of the spectrum, and hopefully that's one that works out for them.
I want it to work just because I want to use the phrase, the Bridges Doctrine, and have that be like the thing, the signature phrase of the Jeff Bridges administration.
You're going to coin that right now.
I'm filing for trademark.
We're going to look 10 years in the future when the Rockies have won 2 World Series in a row, and we're going to go back to the Purple Dino podcast number, what are we on, 40-something?
56
Tyler
now.
Mond coined 56.
Yep.
Excuse me, you guys are getting after it. Tyler Mond coined the Breidich doctrine with how he turned the Rockies organization around.
When Kyle Parker got promoted a couple weeks ago, I went to the Twitter advanced search and found the very first ever use of hashtag free Kyle Parker on Twitter. And it was something that we used back in August because I knew that we had invented free Kyle Parker. And I am absolutely that petty as to point it out.
No, I remember seeing it on. I remember seeing it on your Twitter account. You guys going off on that. I'm like, free Kyle Parker. Like, what do you mean free him? Then I started looking at his number. I'm like, oh, okay. I see they want him up in the big leagues. I get it.
It all makes sense now. Jason Hurts of Root Sports, hey. And a guy who once pitched a game on one human leg, and also has had to work through probably as painful as pitching a game on one healthy leg. Had to work through the technological issues that we had over the last 24 hours. Thanks, man.
My pleasure, guys. Anytime. You guys are a lot of fun to talk to. The one thing I forgot that I mentioned yesterday that I really like to kind of emphasize with people with John Gray, and I think I mentioned it yesterday on the podcast you deleted, is that, you know, John Gray, I think after his last start, you know, and nobody's asked him the question yet, is what have you learned from your first two starts in the big leagues? And I would hope that his answer is that I can pitch at the big league level, that I don't belong in AAA. And I think that's very important for Rockies fans to understand, is that as a pitcher, when you know that you don't belong at that lower level, that you need to be at the big league level, that's a huge step in the development of a player when they figure out that they don't need to play around with the scrubs anymore. It's time to play with the big boys. And I hope that that's where he's at in his career right now, or at least in his mindset, because that goes a long way toward big league success.
He is Jason Hurts. You can find him on Twitter. He is at jhirsch5280. And you can also stop by the Legends Baseball Softball Academy, which is now in a new facility. You can go make yourself a better baseball player, or make your son or daughter a better baseball player. You guys do softball stuff, right?
Yeah, it's kind of sketchy. We got a ball. Okay. We got a bucket of softballs. That's kind of our softball academy.
That's a big thing.
Like five or six softballs. But no, it's a huge market, especially in Central Denver. It's one that we haven't really tapped into yet, but we're really trying to get into. We don't have any softball machines. We just have regular baseball machines. But you can definitely come in and, you know, you can do your softball hitting, and we have tees and things like that. So you can pretty much do everything except for take batting practice off the machine. And yeah, you know, we're at 1338 South Valentia, number 175, right next to the Copper Kettle Brewery. So you can drop your kid off, get a lesson, go grab a beer.
That's fantastic.
And come on back afterwards.
That is awesome. And they have MLB spec mounds made from the same dirt at Coors Field.
Yeah, exactly. It's big league spec. I consulted with Mark Rasm over at Coors. Big league clay, 10 inches tall, got an inch of drop for every foot of run. So it's definitely big league spec, and it's probably the best best mounds that anybody's going to throw off of in Denver other than being at Coors Field.
That is awesome. So go check out the Legends Baseball Academy over on Valentia Street. And Jason, as always, man, we cannot thank you enough. Great stuff, and we'll do it again soon.
Absolutely. Anytime you guys need me, just make sure you hit the record button next time.
Jason Hurts of Root Sports, our guest. Again, you can follow Jason on Twitter at jhirsch5280, and a guy who's had his finger on the pulse of this organization for a long time, and I think has sort of always, in his line of work and in his opinion, always been of the opinion that you kind of need to try something different at Coors Field. And is, you know, the discussion of the way the Rockies are trying to build something that they haven't done before is the most important thing to come out of all this.
Yeah.
However good John Gray is, however good Jeff Hoffman is, none of it matters unless there's an organizational change in philosophy of this is what's going to be successful.
Right, exactly. And that's, you have to credit Jeff Breidich and company for maybe taking a new tact with it. Obviously, we don't know if these guys are going to pan out yet, but you have to wait and see for a couple of years and see if these guys can actually make their mark in the big leagues. Jeff Hoffman, you can't imagine, is very, very far away from the big leagues. He's in AA right now, pitching very well. He's made, what, 4 AA starts all told in his career, but he was a guy who was seen as a fast riser coming up anyway out of Eastern Carolina. So seeing him pitch well by the end of the year and maybe next year coming into spring training, getting some chances at the big league level, maybe not coming out in big league camp right away, but at least, you know, making an impact by the middle of next season, you have to hope that that can be the case. John Gray, I don't see him not being in the starting rotation
now
at the beginning of next year. I mean, in terms of talent, he could easily start opening day. It's just a matter of, you know, if they want to give Kyle Kendrick a second shot.
Yeah. Might as well.
Because, yeah. I mean, you know, he's earned it.
Oh,
right?
Man. That
right?
is one guy that I don't really care to see ever again.
Ever again. Yeah.
But a big thanks to Jason Hirsch. We're going to wrap things up for episode number 56 of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. Jeff Hoffman, by the way, we're recording this on Thursday. He does go tonight for the New Britain Rockcats, so by the time we talk to you again, he will have made two starts. By the time we talk to you next week, last time out, one hit over five innings, looked really good, really, really good. After getting a bit roughed up in his first time out with the AA New Britain Rockcats and the Rockies organization, last time out, very, very good. And so that's the exciting thing is now you have guys to be fired up about.
Yes.
You know, and as we
hung
Saturday, up that call,
Coors Field.
Yeah, yeah, as we hung up that call, it's a rarity that you get excited for a pitching matchup at Coors Field. But John Gray is going to go against Andrew Cashner, and it's like, man, that'll be a good matchup.
Yeah,
when was the last time you ever felt that?
We asked Jason Hirsch, you know, have you ever felt excited about a pitching matchup at Coors Field? And he's like, nah, not since Jason Hirsch versus Randy Johnson.
I would imagine that's something that gets you a little bit fired up. So big thanks to Jason Hirsch, and we're going to wrap things up. I hit Grand Junction this week.
Yes, you did.
I made the trip over to Saplesio Field. If you get a chance to check out Saplesio Field and the Grand Junction Rockies, 4-hour drive from Denver, not too terrible. And it's fun. It's a fun little ballpark. It's kind of a hodgepodge. It's an old facility that incorporates some new stuff as part of like a whole sports complex out there. So the home plate area on the third base side are all old bleachers, but the first base side and the giant press tower there are all part of that complex along with Stoker Field where they share a press box, which is really cool. There's one half that looks out over the football field for Colorado Mesa games. The other half looks over Saplesio Field for Grand Junction Rockies games. Got a hospitality suite, all that kind of stuff. It's cool, though. I like Grand Junction. It's a place that I will be heading back to because it was fun to catch a little baby Rocks game out there.
I've only been able to drill on my trips out from Denver to L.A. before, and it looks awesome. I would love to go to a game there. And considering we had the GM here on the old podcast before, and
we did, old Tim Ray.
I think Peach Night is coming up
tomorrow. Actually, I think it was last night.
Last night,
but they had Olathe Sweet Corn Night, and then they had Palisade Peach Night.
That's right.
And I had the idea I threw out on Twitter, and I'm very serious about it. That I really think they should rebrand as the Peaches,
the Grand Junction Peaches.
That would. Or the Grand Valley.
That's
peaches,
true.
As Daniel Jeffrey suggested, because since the peaches come from Palisade, you don't want to anger the Palisade people by claiming them as Grand Junction
true.
Peaches, but call them the Grand Valley peaches.
And set. You could just
seriously.
Do like League of Their Own kind of stuff and wear like
exactly.
old Rockford Peaches uniforms.
A baseball tie-in.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
At least one day a year.
Yeah. I could be
yeah, I'd be totally down with that.
So go check out our Grand Junction Rockies game. They're a whole lot of fun. Not a huge crowd that night, and you know, you can kind of walk around, check out the ballpark from any vantage point. It's a cool place, and it's neat to see those kids at the start of their professional career, 18, 19 years old, because you don't get to see that a whole lot in the minors unless you're around
yeah.
one of those low level rookie teams. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely worth it. Definitely worth it.
So, that's going to do it for episode number 56 of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. You can give us a follow on Twitter. We are at Purple DinoCast. Anthony is at Master Tones. I'm at Tyler Mon. Check out the podcast on Purple Rowan on ESPNDenver.com. You can also get our t-shirts, HumbleMonster.com. Still selling the Purple Dinosaur Podcast t-shirts. And we got new ones coming out shortly.
We always say.
So, until next week. I don't know what we'll talk about then. But we will talk with our good pal Matt Replinger about his work with the yoga stuff that he does with Major League teams. We'll probably talk a little Denver baseball history and have a whole pile of fun as we always do.
Hell yeah.
We'll try.
As always.
Until next week. Talk to you then.
Bye.
Bye.
The they, win, they get us for Hawking win. Had I known I'd been told what you could get if you'd only give a pound of skin.
All right, I have a new roll of cassette tapes ready. I got some Super 8s ready to record on today.
Make sure you have a redundant system set up for backup recording.
Oh, my God. I was so annoyed. I am still so annoyed. It, like, ruined my day yesterday. It was amazing. But, hey, we live in amazing times because Anthony...
Just like it never happened.
I
yeah,
know.
Exactly.
Anthony woke up early and is going into work late in order to rejoin the interview.
Yeah, so...
Wow. Thank you, Anthony. Appreciate it.
Special times, yeah. Jason Hirsch.
You guys, I'm just...
Well, you can blame Tyler for this one.
Absolutely.
Oh, trust me.
Absolutely.
I do and I will.
Tell Pete Rose that it was my fault.
I'll tell Pete Rose on you.
All right. Well, this is finally recording, so let's knock this out with the exact same interview as yesterday.
Yeah, you mean you forgot to hit record the last time? Is that what you're saying?
So I installed Windows 10 on my computer, and it has screwed up like everything on here. And so I had it recording. It said,
"Well,
like,
that's what you get for installing something brand new right out of the box."
Well, and like it kept popping up on my screen, and it was like Windows 10 update is available, and I was like, "All right, well, I haven't heard the media freak out of Windows 8.
Wait until Service Pack 1 comes out. Then you can install Windows 10.
That is probably what I should have done.